over the burned ground, ashes accumulating on his wet fur, running toward a horrible, shambling shape coming down the slope, a half-blind sow bear with most of her fur burned off and showing great raw swatches of roasted skin. She passed the cub and lumbered on toward the river where she fell in, half stood, and began to drink and drink and drink. The teamster, Gineau, and Victor Gouche came out of the river and began the long walk to Fredericton. They had only shuffled half a mile when Gineau understood his legs had been burned. His charred pants had mostly disappeared, and in places the wool cloth baked into the flesh. In the river he had hardly felt the pain, but in the open air and with gritty ash blowing against the open wounds, the pain rose up in great waves. His endurance had burned down to a clinker, and he fell. He was lying naked on a rush mat. Above, birch bark slanted upward to a cluster of pole ends and a blackened smoke hole. He thought about it a long time. The realization came very slowly as he drifted in and out of consciousness. For the first time in his life, he was in a wigwam. He was alone. His eyes were sore, but he could see. He could smell something sweet and faintly familiar that attached to memories of pond edges. His legs itched and hurt intolerably, and his thinking wavered and blinked out. When he woke again, the light was very soft. It was twilight. He could smell honey, even taste it. He tried to put his hand to his mouth, but his arm was weak. It fell back and lay inert. His legs itched, and he was violently thirsty. He slept again, half woke when something sweet and wonderful dripped into his sore mouth. The sound of wind woke him. It was gray dawn light. Slowly he remembered pieces of the fire, the burning, his legs, Victor Gouche holding his fork, the swollen red dome of Joe Wax's head. He tried to move his legs, but they were somehow stuck together. He smelled the honey, and the sweet swamp edge fragrance. A voice spoke, but he couldn't understand the words. He thought it was Mi'kmaq, but he had forgotten too many words to be sure. An arm half lifted him up, a cup pressed against his mouth. The liquid was fresh with the taste of pine resin and soothing, and after he swallowed it, a deep lassitude overcame him, and he drifted into the dark again, but not so soon that he couldn't smell and almost feel that someone was dripping honey on his legs. A long time later, days or weeks, he knew not which, he came out of his medicinal torpor and saw the broad face of a Mi'kmaq man of middle years, perhaps a few years older than himself. His hooded eyes had the protective coolness of a man deeply acquainted with suffering.
"Where am I? Who?"
he whispered.
"Inuisit. Parle Mi'kmaq,"
the man said.
"No. Few words.
Francais?
1, 2, 3, 4, c'est tout."
"So."
The man said nothing for a long time. Then, in a resigned and sad voice, he continued in English.
"This Indian town, by Shubenacadie. Men bring you here, tie like turkey. Leg burn. Name my Jim Silly Boy. Help burn people. I burn one time, enfant, fall in fire. No pain. Now burn people, here come. Mi'kmaq. Iroquois, even white men. Some better, some die. Burn is very bad, die. You little bad. I think walk one day."
Gineau had heard the name Shubenacadie before and knew it was in Nova Scotia, part of old Mi'kmaq territory. How had he come here from New Brunswick? Who brought him here? Was it that cook, Vic Gouche? What did he mean, walk one day? Of course he would walk. He would dance on the logs again as soon as he had his strength. He had been hurt many times, and always he had healed quickly. He wanted to know about the fire.
Big fire,
was all he could say.
Vers grand incendie. New Brunswick place, all burn up.
There was another long silence. Then Jim Silly Boy sighed.
Tomorrow maybe we start clean leg. Both him. See you move leg. Now, drink medicine. Sleep. Sleep good for burn.
Over the next days, Gino learned that Jim Silly Boy was a renowned burn healer, that people came to him from far distances, bringing children scalded with hot oil, drunks pulled from fireplaces, woodsmen trapped in burning shanties, farmers half-roasted in flaming barns. And now he tended 5 from the Miramichi fire. This wigwam and 3 others like it were special healing places. Jim Silly Boy's son Beto helped him with the burned people.
Long time burn pain. Long time.
His 2 other sons, he said, spent much time roaming in search of bee trees, for honey was essential for treating burns.
Use much honey.
He took no pay for his services, though he was poor.
Ukchiniskum say 1, spirit place. Black robe say brothers. Help, do good.
His unease in speaking English showed in his rough sentences. Slowly, Gino learned that many of the people in Indian Town were poor and miserable, so poor that there was not enough food. The old hunting places and the game had been destroyed, the salmon rivers clogged with logs, bark, and sawdust from mills. Now, said Silly Boy, his people talked of changing Mi'kmaq ways, of growing gardens like the whites so at least there would be food.
Our chief go London. Speak king. Ask how make jardin. We never know this. We try.
With a Mi'kmaq now embracing even more doings of the white men? Gino thought suddenly of Amboise, his embittered brother who liked saloons best in the white man's culture if he had to like anything. And Martel. What of their comrade Joe Martel? Did the fire reach Bartibogue? When Jim Silly Boy came in the evening, Gino asked him for information.
Can no one tell me about the fire? You say it burned up New Brunswick. Could not burn up all New Brunswick. Très big place. Many rivières, he said,
hauling out a few French words.
I hear all burn. I look somebody. For tell you. Maybe find that man you bring.
The next day, Silly Boy gently cleaned the honey from his legs. He rolled Gino on his side, said the back of the right leg was the worst.
Big scar come you, I think.
This meant nothing to Gino. Scars were common. Scars didn't kill you. Scars were the proofs of survival. But as the weeks and months went on, he discovered their cruelty. The cicatrices made him a walking dead man, for the scarred back of his right leg contracted painfully and made it almost impossible for him to walk. When he tried, it was to hobble with tremendous pain, and he could manage only a few steps. The scar froze his leg in an unnatural position. All through the winter, he lay in the wigwam. Early in his recovery, when Jim Silly Boy examined the itchy, healing wounds, he explained in words and gestures that the scar was tout enfant for his special massage that would make it a little softer and more flexible. Beto would do this. It was his skill. He would use a special salve Jim Silly Boy compounded of the Mila Iliwiganek, the 7 kinds of healing herbs, roots, bark, and needles. He made another good salve of beaver fat and the gum of Ukchimawachka, the white spruce. And there were useful decoctions and teas which he would teach Gino to make himself from the good ingredients. For the scar was now his master, and it would demand a lifetime of care. The fire had been the salient point of his life. He had an absolute knowledge that nothing, nothing, would ever be as it had been. One day, sitting outside the healing wigwam in a special chair, he had a visitor. A lanky white man came striding down the path. Jeannot didn't know who he was, but hated him for his good legs. The man stopped in front of him.
"Member me? Vic Gucci? Born Gautier, but they call me Gucci? We was in the fire and the river? Brung you here with Lou Green?
Dragged a damn wagon with an old black horse. He got burned up, you know. Most of the crew got it. But Lou heard about this Indian, Jim Syllabub. He's a burn healer. I had to get away from New Brunswick anyhow. Place is all black and stinking, so we brung you here. Lou Green had his right ear burned off, and Syllabub fixed him up good. Course, his ear is gone, just a little bit of skin left, but he's up and around. Figured he might do the same for you, seeing you got me to run down to the river. I was going to stay in the shanty, figured the fire would never take it, but when you come running and half on fire yelling, run, run, I changed my mind. So I'm alive and hardly got scorched. Remember that sow bear on fire? She died right there, and the cub just kept on trying to suck. It was a bad fire.
God save me, said Jeannot. I want to know about that fire. How big? What they say? I got a brother, Amboise, working up on the big Bartibogue.
Very bad, that place. Fire come in, burned her up. They say 3 million acres of good timber burned. Towns, houses, jails, lumber camps, sawmills. Half of Fredericton got it.
Amboise and Joe Martel, said Jeannot. Oh, my brother, my friend. It can't be the fire killed them.
Must have. More'n 100 people got it.
Jeannot could not speak for choking. Gucci waited. He sighed to express sorrow for Jeannot's people. Then he spoke softly.
We was lucky we made it. Especially me.
How your legs coming along?
Jeannot snuffled a little, then spoke in the hard and angry voice of someone who puts bad news behind him and gets on.
Slow. Silly boy says it takes a long time. The scar draws up my leg so I can't walk good. Can't do much.
He slapped the side of his right leg to indicate that it was the most damaged limb.
Well, I come to ask if you want to go back out west. Work the Gatineau.
Jeannot, unable to stop thinking about Amboise, shook his head.
I just told you I can't do nothing now. And I got no clothes except what Silly Boy got from the priest. Can't do no work. Not a chance I can do woods work now.
Hell, you can cook, can't you? That's the law. People get hurt in the woods, they cook. I can't cook nothing but fish. Can't stand up for long, just 2-3 minutes. I tell you, the burn pulls my leg up hard. I don't know how I'll get along. I want to get away from here. Silly boys, all of them. Been good, but this is a hard place. Hungry. Poor. No money, no job, no hunting, nothing. I don't belong here no more. If I ever did. If I could maybe get to my brother in Manitoulin, let him know what happened, I might work out some things.
Hell, Jeannot, I'll take you out of here. Manitoulin, if that's where you want to go. You saved my life. I ain't forgetting that.
I gotta get healed up first. Silly boy says a couple more months, this fall maybe, I might be walking. Some. I gotta get so I can move around better. I'm just crippled this way.
Say what? You get Syllabub fix you up some more, and I'll come get you.
Let's see, it is now just about June. Drives are on.
What say I come back October, see how you go. Maybe you'd be better, and we'll see what.
He left, and Jeannot thought Gucci was a good man, though he'd never paid him any attention before the fire. He cried again for Amboise, his older brother, a drinker, a dreamer of past days he never knew, now lost to him forever. Amboise, who hated cutting the forest, but did it because when they went into new woods, he felt he was entering a past world. Amboise, who drank whiskey to get away from the present. The son, Beto Silly Boy, showed him there was something more that could be done besides the gentle massage and softening salves. He coaxed the stiff, scar-bound leg into positions that hurt, very gradually stretching the clenching scar, moving the leg carefully, carefully, not to tear the stiff tissue. So by September, almost a year after the fire, Jeannot could limp slowly. The leg was dreadfully painful, a kind of pain like no other, tedious and biting, angry and gripping, and he could see how the scar held his leg under tension. He said one day to Jim Sillyboy, "If you was to cut right here, seems to me it would let the leg stretch more. That scar is like a rope tying me up. Just a little cut where that thick place binds, eh?" But Jim Sillyboy did not want to make such a cut. So Jeannot was no good for the woods or other heavy work. He had no money, everything lost in the fire. And when Gucci came back, he would have to say he could not go with him. He would have to stay in Indian Town until he died, poor, hungry, and crippled. He saw that life in front of him. But he tried once more with Beto Sillyboy, saying that one little cut might make the scar easier. Beto thought he was right. "We do it. I get good knife, old kind. Black stone, she ver sharp." And he came the next day with a wicked little slant of fresh flaked obsidian and made the cut, put on healing salve and an eel-skin binding to hold the leg in a more open position. In a week, Jeannot was hobbling around, and Jim Sillyboy admitted the cut had been useful.
"But some, it don't work. You lucky."
"Oh, yes. I am lucky," said Jeannot. When Vic Gucci came in October, Jeannot told him he wanted to go to Boston and find Elise, to see his nieces and nephews. He wanted next to find Josime on Manitoulin Island and count up more nieces and nephews. He had come out of the year of trial by fire, wanting children. Gucci looked at him and drew down his lips.
"You want kids? Way most folks get 'em is get married and do that thing. Find you a woman girl and get married. Hell, I've been married twice and got some kids in Bangor, two more in Waterville. Why, I keep working, send them all the money I make. You know plenty women. I seen you jabbering with 'em four to whack. Snatch one out."
Jeannot knew a trip to Boston was stupid. He had no money. He would not know where to begin the search for Elise in a city squirming with people. And Gucci said he had maybe promised too much when he said he could get Jeannot to Manitoulin. He was grateful for having his life saved, but he wanted some time to live it.
"Your talk about kiddos made me itch to see the ones I got. Turn over a new leaf. But I'll keep my eyes open. See if I find any work you can do. I know you can learn cooking and get took on with a lumber camp. It's all beans and pork anyway. Easy. Hell, I done it for years. Nobody never died from beans and pork."
Jeannot did not want to cook, to hobble around the shanty cook stove while strong men cut and limbed in the fragrant forest. No. He borrowed a dollar from Vic Gucci, shook his hand and thanked him for his trouble, said he would send him back the dollar when he found work. He went with the dollar to the first saloon he could find.
"Whiskey."
Though he preferred rum, whiskey was the cheapest drink. For 20 cents, he bought a bottle of the cheapest. This was his first binge since the fire. The pain faded and faded as he drank, and he suddenly felt very well, even happy. He smiled to himself and poured more in his glass.
"Spare some of that,"
said the man next to him, a heavy-set fellow in wool pants with calloused hands and a long gray face. He was a lumberman from his looks.
"Hold on," said Jeannot. "Here she comes."
And he poured liberally. He discovered the man was Resolve Smith, part Passamaquoddy, and had worked the Penobscot as a master driver, knew the river country well. He, too, had crippled legs, both broken in a rollway accident.
"Old damn pile knocked me flat. Come down on my legs, and I could see every one of them logs before it hit me. Broke my legs into pieces like a stick, and they set crooked. Awful when it rains."
Jeannot told him about the fire on the Miramichi that swept New Brunswick, and how Amboise and Martel had perished in the fire, and he himself had been crippled. The next hour was devoted to stories of Woods fires, Amboise, Martel, injuries. They finished the bottle together, and Jeannot bought another. After a long time, they fell silent. Then Smith said,
"You looking for work?"
"Looking for work, but I can't do Woods work no more."
"Me neither. But there's something I heard. These fellers in Massachusetts or somewhere are starting up a axe factory. Make the heads in numerous numbers. They looking for men, no axes. So I heard. You been an axe man a long time. You know axes."
"Like I know a tree," Jeannot said. "All kind of axe. All my life since I was a kid, I lived with an axe in my hand."
"Let's go up there. See, can we get us a job? Hell, we'll have good drinking and good times."
They agreed to meet the next noon in front of the saloon. 50. A Twisted Life. Mr. Albert Bone pushed his baby face forward, the whitest face Jeannot had ever seen, ice-blue eyes set deep, and mouth fixed in a knot. He resembled a wizened child, but spoke in a voice that was asymmetrically large. He fitted two fingers of his right hand into his watch pocket, gazed at Jeannot, who shifted his weight, uncomfortable in the confines of the office.
"What can you tell me of the axe? Have you made axes?"
The questions rumbled.
"Never made one. Wore out a good many fallen pine in Penobscot and Gatineau. 20 years of chopping. Know a bad axe. Used quite a few."
He was exhausted by all this talk.
"So, Mr. Jeannot Sell, would you say this was a good axe or a bad axe?"
And Babyface turned and grasped a fresh-faced axe that lay on his desk, gave it helve first to Jeannot, who, after the shock of being addressed as Mister, hefted it, turned it every which way, sighted down the handle, peered closely, looking for the weld, which he did not see, ran his thumb carefully along the bit edge. He took an attenuated swing.
"You got a tree or a log?" he said. "Better try it before I say nothing."
For he knew this was a test. They went out into the fresh morning, mist lifting from the river. Two crows cawed amiably from the invisible far side. Mr. Bone pointed at a chestnut tree, perhaps 10 inches through, on the bank. Jeannot limped over to it, took his stance, swung the axe. It bit, and the chips flew. It was a young tree, and did not deserve to be cut. It was not as yielding as soft pine, but he had it on the ground in minutes, and thought that if he had had any half-submerged thought of chopping for a living again, he could drown it. He was slow now, and each stroke shot a pang through his scarred leg.
"Good axe," he said. "Quality."
"Yes. I and the men I have trained are dedicated to making the best axes. Quality is everything, and a man who works for me must swear to uphold the growing reputation of these axes. This is the Penobscot model. Let me ask you a question. You are an Indian, I suppose?"
A tiny ding came from his vest pocket. Ah, thought Jeannot, he only hires white men.
"I am Mi'kmaq, from Nova Scotia. They say there's a Frenchman way back there. Great-great-grand-père Sell."
He half-turned to go. There was still time to find Resolve Smith in one of the saloons and tie one on. But he added,
"I lived in Maine most of my life."
Bone talked, his words flowing into the mist.
"I have a particular regard for Indians. I know English newcomers practiced great injustices on them, and in my life I have tried to make up for those malfeasances. I have ever believed that if your people had resisted the first explorers, you would still be living in the forest, gathering nuts. I have, in my own way, sought to repair injustices when I can."
As he talked, he strolled back to his office, limiting his stride to accommodate Jeannot's limp.
"To that end, I hire some Indians. I find Indians have an instinctive ability for mechanical improvements and invention. My foreman, Mr. Joseph Dogg, for example."
The little mouth twitched. Gino stood speechless. He had never heard a white man make such talk. He didn't like it. When they reached the door, Mr. Bone drew a gold watch from his pocket and pressed a button. It sang sweetly, telling the nearest hour. The sun found a hole in the thinning mist, and the watch glittered.
Mr. Gino Sell, you will learn the processes of forging and tempering. I need good men in those skills. And grinding and filing, we will try you there. It would be to our mutual advantage if you learned every facet of axe manufacture. What do you say, yes? All right. I will take you on, and you may do good work, for I know I will lose money until you grasp the essentials. Go with that man there, my foreman, Mr. Dog. He'll show you the ropes, as mariners say.
He nodded at a hunchback Métis who stood inside the hallway grinning, not more than 30 years old. Gino nodded, but trembled inside. He was hired. It had been so easy.
Iroquois, Seneca, said Joe Dog to his unasked question. Come on.
And they rushed back out the door and through the yard, Dog pointing out Mr. Bone's array of buildings.
He's a fair man, said Dog, no matter what you hear.
They walked into the forge shop, a room of fire and hammering where men cut hot iron stock.
You'd think I'd ever get hired by somebody else? No, sir. Mr. Bone says I am his Hephaestus, though I have not yet forged any thunderbolts.
And do you too have comely maidens to help you?
Asked Gino, dredging up Beatrix's accounts of the Greek gods. Joe Dog laughed with delight.
Ha! You're an educated engine, ain't you? And it don't do you no good at all, eh? Tell you, there's more than Gino Sell can read books, he declared, indicating himself.
Gino watched a mope-faced man take up a metal bar and lay it on an anvil. While he held it in place, another man scored it with hammer and cold chisel and broke the bar.
Them patterns is the start. They make up into axes, said Dog. A man, if he's any good, makes 8 axes a day. If he's no good, he can make 10 or 12.
They walked on into the din. Gino had never seen a trip hammer before, and here were 6 of the pounding things, tireless in their idiot strength. The stone floor trembled.
Every one of them bastards gets its own water wheel for power, bellowed Dog.
At the grinding shop, they stepped into an oppressive roar punctuated by the soft coughing of men who inhaled steel dust all day long. A row of stone wheels, 6 to 8 feet in diameter, stood along one wall, their rotation making a hoarse, wet whisper. Men, grasping the new axes, bent over the speeding stones.
Now, said Dog in a normal voice when they stepped outside, over there is workers' lodging. You go there and they'll give you own room. Anything you want to know, you ask me.
Gino began to learn the skills and subtle judgments of axemakers. In the forge house, his old River Drive reactions to the quixotries of moving water and rolling logs translated into recognition of gradations of the shapes and colors of hot metals, quickly, delicately turning the axe under the descending hammer blows, all motion in the deafening heat, like running dreamlike through a chamber of the inferno. It was the Miramichi fire compressed into a bed of coals, the hurricane wind blowing only at the command of the bellows. Those dark wraiths in the room were not men of nerve and skill, but demons, beckoning him to their damned society. Dog, his tutor, talked about himself.
How I come to leave that Iroquois country in upstate York? Why, smart white men, they get our property. Iroquois don't think that way. Sell it, but we so foolish think it's still ours. White man give whiskey, give little presents, and get our hunting land. That land be theirs. They say, Indon, give up them ways you people, Indon, get civilized. So I come here to get civilized, get job. That blacksmith, Mr. Bone, pretty nice to me. He see me down by river, I try catch frog, hungry. He fix me up, learn me to be smith. You maybe never think Mr. Bone can find end of his thing, but he make a good axe.
Good smith. He make a good axe.
This was difficult to believe. Mr. Bone looked so small and childlike. Later, covertly, Jeannot began to study the small frame beneath the black suit, the small hands. He had been deceived by the baby face. The body was small but steely, the little hands calloused and hard. He was drawn to the trip hammers. The hammer man had to be something of an artist, shifting the position of the glowing axe clamped in his tongs for the perfect shape, and he had to be fast. Most racking was the tempering process, which demanded experience and a good eye. Hugh Boss, in his 50s, tall and lopsided from spine-twisting scoliosis, heated a new-shaped axe, then dropped it into a vat of water.
"Makes it so damn brittle the bit will break the first time you use it," said Boss. "So, you gotta draw the temper, eh?"
He winked at Jeannot, and again the axe went to the forge where it was reheated. He worked a file over it.
"Watch the colors edge down to the bit."
Jeannot saw the color parade from pale yellow to orange to dark orange to brown. It went again into the water.
"It'll go all the way to blue, but brown is where we want to axe. There. She's fixed now."
The months slid into years before Mr. Bone was satisfied that the tools Jeannot made could withstand thousands of heavy strikes. It was the richest and strangest part of his life, for he felt he was no longer Jeannot's cell, but someone else, a hybrid creature in a contrived space. Mr. Bone took an interest in him. There were many good Indian men in the factory, but he had fastened on Jeannot, who, with his fresh, smiling face, looked younger than he was. One day, when Mr. Bone had to make a trip to Boston, he told Jeannot to come with him. Alone in the coach, neither spoke for an hour, until Mr. Bone said earnestly,
"I want you to understand all the intricacies of the axe business. I have undertaken to educate Indians such as yourself in the mechanic and manufacturing arts, but there is more to a business than that. The sooner your people leave the forests and adopt useful trades, the sooner the woodlands will become civilized and productive. That is not to say it will be goose pie all the way, no. I wish you to know the business end of axe making. You must learn how to consort with men of quality."
He took out his repeater and pressed the knob. The watch chimed.
"There are problems and troubles that keep me awake at night. Competitors who make an inferior product painted up to look like a bone axe. Workmen who complain they are not paid enough. Some who agitate. Some who are spies for other axe makers. Now it is time you learn how to conduct yourself and speak with businessmen."
Jeannot wanted to say that he did not want to speak with businessmen. He preferred the company of the forge, where, under the blanket of noise, men communicated with hand gestures as did workers in sawmills. He preferred, he didn't know what he preferred, except to be more distant from Mr. Bone's solicitous interest. But Mr. Bone's vaunted enthusiasm for native people did not extend to the forests and shorelines they inhabited. For Mr. Bone, only when the trees were gone, when houses crowded together and the soil was cultivated to grow European crops, was it a real place. On the return journey, he said abruptly, as though he had been long arranging the words in his mind,
"I came from Scotland to Philadelphia with my father. My mother died when I was but an infant. And 2 days after we arrived in this country, father also perished, a victim of some shipboard pestilence. So I was orphaned and thrown on my own resources."
He said nothing more. Months later, they were again alone in a coach that stank of stale urine on the way to Bangor, and Mr. Bone, who seemed unable to speak of his past unless in jolting motion, continued his history.
"Relative to the events of my youth, after I found myself alone in a strange city, but first I begged bread and then coins from passers-by. Then I fell in with some boys who, like myself, were homeless. We contrived a society of cooperative thievery, taking chickens, garden plunder. For amusement, we loitered near the stage stop, the farrier and blacksmith shops, places of interest to all boys. One day I happened to be alone watching one of the smiths, and the man looked at me and said, "Pump the bellows, boy. My helper run off." I pumped that bellows. At day's end, he told me I was employed. I filled the tempering baths, pumped the bellows, ran errands, and learned the best uses of the hardies, swages, bicks, holdfasts, and mandrels, the 20 kinds of hammers, the 50 kinds of tongs, the punches and chisels. When Mr. Judah Bitter, the smith, saw I was interested, he undertook to tutor me in the arcane lore of the forge and anvil. Even blacksmithing has its heroes, and Mr. Bitter was such a one. He inculcated in me a love for the black metal. Well do I remember the day I made my first adze.
Embedded in this strew of words, Jeannot scented a clue. Mr. Bone favored him because he glimpsed something that made him equate Jeannot's situation with that of the poor orphan emigrant. Jeannot could understand that for Joe Dog, but not for himself. Or did Mr. Bone see him as a lump of raw iron that needed heating and pounding to be made into a tool? His employer drew his gold watch from its pocket and smiled at it.
"My family treasure."
The coach stopped and three more travelers boarded, but Mr. Bone was wrought up and he continued in a hissing whisper he imagined reached only Jeannot's ear. His breath reeked of strong peppermint from the candy he kept in his pocket.
"Mr. Bitter favored me with an invitation to join him as partner in his smithy. There would be a new sign, Bitter and Bone. It sounds well, does it not?"
He noticed then that the entire population of the coach was staring at him agog, and shut up. But when they were at the rough inn, Mr. Bone returned to his subject.
"As I said, Mr. Bitter offered me a partnership. I accepted. But before the arrangements were complete, Mr. Bitter, on his way home from the smithy, was run down by a profligate Jehu swilled to the gills. The smithy went by inheritance law to an idiot nephew who could not tell an anvil from an anthill. Once more I was bereft and alone and without resources. I looked about me to discover what I might do. I saw the vast forests, saw the great need of thousands of people to build houses and barns, and so I decided on the axe. I recognized the opportunity and vowed my axes would be the best."
Emboldened by the toddy, Jeannot had to ask,
"Why favor me, Mr. Bone? I do wonder."
There was a long silence. Then Mr. Bone stirred, sighed, and spoke.
"When I saw the great injustices that my race visited on the native population, I took a private vow to encourage young Indian men to take up a trade. It is the Christian way. Had I not become a smith, I might have been drawn to the missionary life among the heathen. It is my hope that you may become the first Indian businessman, a part of the society in which you now live. Do you visit your people often? If not, you should, for there may be excellent business opportunities to be discovered. I think I have shown you how to see those opportunities."
Jeannot shuddered inwardly. Hugh Boss, the hammerman, became a friend, and Jeannot began to spend Saturday evenings at the family household playing checkers. The Boss family lived in a large cabin a mile from the factory. Mrs. Boss, a pretty woman with wheat-colored hair and wide hips, was usually swollen with pregnancy. She hovered constantly over the cast-iron cooking range and was a notable cook. But what Jeannot liked were the children, for the Boss family was large, from Minnie at 16, the oldest, to Baby, barely a year old, and eight more in between. Minnie, petite, dark-haired, and dark-eyed, had inherited Hugh Boss's scoliosis, and once a month had to visit Dr. Mallard for cruel stretching exercises. In the doctor's stretching room, she removed all her clothing above the waist, for the doctor had to observe her spine, stepped under an enormous tripod, where he fitted her into a complicated system of straps and pads that was his own invention. She was mightily stretched, almost hoisted into the air, while Dr. Mallard adjusted the tension to force her spine into a straighter position. She told Jeannot that at first she had been ashamed to stand half-naked before the doctor, but he was indifferent to anything but the curve of her spine
and she no longer went crimson with embarrassment. After each treatment, Minnie was carried home, exhausted by the ordeal. Jeannot, who understood the pain of stretching recalcitrant muscles and tissues, sometimes read aloud to her while she lay on the kitchen daybed with the coverlet drawn up under her small chin. She was not a pretty girl, but kind-natured despite the pain of her infirmity, and she responded to Jeannot's sympathy with growing love, which did not escape Hugh Boss's eye. For a long time, nothing was said, and he got used to the idea of Minnie and Jeannot together, despite the years between them. When Dr. Mallard said Minnie was much improved and he would allow 2 months between stretching sessions, the family declared a celebration. Hugh Boss gave her money for dress fabric. That Sunday, she appeared in the new dress, and Jeannot's eyes went wide. The dress was the marvelous blue of Beatrix's old dressing gown, and it was silk. Hugh Boss took Jeannot out to the cow barn where he kept his jugs of hard cider.
"See here, Jeannot. You know Minnie likes you a terrible lot."
"I like her, too?" He fidgeted.
"Well, there's nothing to it, then. We'll get the hitching post set up."
A month later, they were married in the front room of the Boss house. Minnie wore her blue silk dress, and through the brief ceremony, they could all hear the oaths and struggles of the men heaving up logs for the bridal couple's cabin in the back corner of Hugh Boss's pasture. Minnie thought of the flower game she played as a girl, pulling petals off a daisy to discover who she would marry. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief. Well, he wasn't a chief. With the birth of his and Minnie's first children, twin boys, Amboise and Aaron, who resembled Kuntah more than Hugh Boss, it seemed to Jeannot that now he was like other men, and could nearly understand once mysterious truths. It could not last. Minnie was a nervous mother, daily inspecting the posture of the boys to see if there were signs of scoliosis. She took Amboise and Aaron to Dr. Mallard as soon as they began walking, but he saw no sign of the deformity.
"Of course, my dear, it can always appear later in life, often not visible even to the expert eye." He blinked modestly. "Until well underway. We shall keep a close watch on the children, bring them in for consultation every 6 months, and we shall hope to catch it early if it in fact appears, and correct any malformation. As for yourself, I had hopes that childbearing would help augment the stretching sessions you so bravely endured, but it seems it is not so. It has come to endurance rather than cure." It was so. Minnie bent more and more to the left, her posture at table a decided lean. The left shoulder of her old jacket hanging on the wooden hook near the door hung low. She worried about everything, that her father would catch a hand under the relentless hammer, that Jeannot would disappear, for he often enough went away with Mr. Bone on business, that disease or pestilence would take them all. Many nights she woke shuddering from dreams of her children being torn apart by hydrophobic dogs, stretching out imploring little hands to her, and she, straining every muscle but bound by her twisted back, unable to reach them, but forced to hear their piteous cries. Hugh Boss made play objects for the children one winter, a glass-smooth birch plank with strips of polished steel embedded in the underside for snow sliding, a kind of toboggan. There was a stand of young spruce at the bottom of their sloping land, a favorite resort for the neighborhood children in summer, as the narrow passages between the trees were a twisted maze, greenish and shadowy tunnels ideal for eye spy, and the noisy intricacies of sheep and wolf. Jeannot sometimes joined them in this game, they, the sheep, scampering through the tunnels, Jeannot, the ferocious howling wolf. In winter, the snowy slope was the neighborhood sliding place. The winter Amboise and Aaron were six, a freakish rainstorm gave Sam Withers, a prankish neighbor boy, the idea of sprinkling even more water on the already icy slide that it might freeze. A sharp temperature plunge converted the slope to a trackless, icy pitch. Sam Withers, claiming responsibility for the ice, took the first ride. The plank swerved and curveted at speed, Sam screeching with excitement at his brilliant success.
Me! Me next!
Three boys squeezed together on the plank for the second ride, Sam in the back, then Aaron, and in the front, Amboise. The greater weight gave the object more speed and a less wavering track. The toboggan could not be steered, and remorselessly curved toward the spruce bosk, the metal strips on the underside of the ride setting up a whine, and every tiny ridge in the ice producing a clatter that gave proof of great speed. There was no avoiding the spiky trees, and the conveyance plunged into the naked lower branches like a meteorite. Minnie heard Aaron's shriek and Sam Withers's bawling roar for the whipping he knew he would get. She ran out in her apron, one shoe lost in the snow. On the icy slope, she saw the boys entangled in the spruce, saw bloody-faced Aaron on hands and knees crawling toward her, saw Sam Withers stumble deeper into the trees, saw Amboise inert. She slipped and fell, and had to creep to reach him. Amboise lay on his right side, pierced through the neck by a dry stick spear one of the children had left in the trees during the days of summer games. The pulsing fountain of blood was already down to a trickle, and she gave a cry that shook the limbs of the forest. Jeannot became grave and serious after the death of young Amboise. Away with Mr. Bone, he had not found out until late that evening when their coach returned. By then, Minnie and Aaron had fallen into a fatalistic calm. The three-year-old twins, Louis and Lancey, slept, unknowing, uncaring. Jeannot went outside and walked the night with spasmodic spells of choking cries, returning to the house a little before dawn. When he came in, cold and exhausted, Minnie, driven by habit, was making tea. They sat together at the blue-painted kitchen table, their hands locked as though all that could not be said could be understood through gripping fingers. The firelight shone from the grate and colored red the tears on their cheeks. The house was somber for days until Louis and Lancey began to laugh and run again. The loss of Amboise reawakened Jeannot's hunger for relatives, and he decided to find Elise and Josime. He began by constructing a careful and painful letter to Francis Outher, for at least he knew he lived on Penobscot Bay, and he was sure the half-brother would know where Elise and Dr. Halliger were. He sent off his letter with trepidation, and doubted he would ever receive a reply. It was almost comical how quickly a letter came.
Dear Jeannot, I was inexpressibly delighted to have your missive. How glad I am that mother's lessons were not forgot. We have long wondered what adventure you have undergone, and your description of the terrible Miramichi fire, your injuries and the loss of our brother Amboise and your little son was painful to read. But it seems you have fallen on good times from your benefactor, Mr. Albert Bone. You have been fortunate, too, in choosing a wife, and in your wealth of children. I can grant your wish to know the whereabouts of Elise. She and Dr. Halliger have a domicile in Boston. The address is below. Their youngest son, Humphrey, has an unusual medical condition where the muscles of the body somehow convert to bone. Learned doctors come to the house to examine and prescribe, but nothing really makes the ailment better. The poor child likely has not long to live before he is solid bone. I am sure Elise would screech with joy if you were to pay a call on her. Boston is not so far distant from you, nor is Penobscot, and you are ever welcome here. As for Josime, your account of parting with him in Montreal is the most recent news. I have felt rather pained that he has never seen fit to write me, as we are full blood brothers. I suffer bouts of pleurisy and debilitating headaches, but suppose one must expect such ailments as one ages. I will close now, as I wish to get this off in the next post. I hope we may soon meet again and exchange news, at the very least, that we may continue to correspond. Your affectionate half-brother, Francis Outher Sell. Penobscot Bay, Maine. Now Elise was on Jeannot's mind constantly. A fortnight later, on a brilliant April day so enriched with untimely summer warmth that the horses took pleasure in being alive, tossed their heads and looked at the azure sky,
he took the stage to Boston and began his search on foot. He had not written, thinking a surprise visit would be better. A bit of drama for Elise. He took half a day asking directions before he found the Halligers' plain brick two-story house. There was a clapboard addition on the south side and a sign reading, Dr. Halliger, M.D. Elise herself opened the red front door. She had become a middle-aged woman with a knot of black-gray hair, but she had the same impish sparkle in her eyes, the same curling smile and pointed teeth as all the cells. She knew him at once.
Gino, you are my brother, Gino!
They embraced in a mighty hug, and Elise began to cry.
Oh, how long I have waited to hear something of you! Francis Outher wrote and told me he had a letter from you asking news of us. Come with me, dear brother. Come with me for a moment, and then we shall go in.
She drew him to a side yard, removed six fragrant loaves of wheaten bread from an old clay oven, wrapped them in a piece of muslin, and carried them to the kitchen.
Now, Gino, you must tell me everything.
He followed her down a dim hall, the plaster walls hung with likenesses of stags drinking from mountain pools, into a stuffy parlor, where his own reflection in a tall, mottled mirror frightened him. A pale, listless boy of 10 or 12 lay dozing on a daybed with a closed book resting on his breastbone.
"This is my boy Humphrey,"
said Elise, bending over the child and kissing his hair. The boy opened his eyes and looked at Gino.
"This is your Uncle Gino,"
said Elise.
"Ah,"
said the boy and closed his eyes.
"Come into the kitchen, Gino. I will make us a pot of tea,"
said Elise.
"Or coffee, if you like. It is almost time for the doctor to come in for his pick-me-up. He will be very pleased to see you."
But when Dr. Halliger came in, he was less than delighted, gave a brusque handshake, then sat at the table blowing on his tea.
"So you found us out," he said in the tone of a captured criminal. "I thought that as so many years have passed, for the sake of our children, it would be good to be in touch with each other again."
He told them of the great Miramichi fire, of Amboise's death in that fire, without mentioning the town jail or drunkenness. He told them of Minnie, of his children, of little Amboise's accident. It was only when he described the kindness of Mr. Bone and his favors over the years that Dr. Halliger relaxed. Gino guessed that he had been expecting to be asked for a loan, and that he was relieved to hear Gino was independent enough to support a wife and three children. When he returned to his surgery, the visit became jollier with Elise and Gino trading old stories and do-you-remembers, plans for a family gathering on the 4th of July, and bits of gossip about distant Mi'kmaq relatives, for there were countless cells in Nova Scotia, all descended from René Cell, the little-known Frenchman who had started their history. Elise remembered a few of them, but Gino knew none.
"We even heard something of our grandfather Quintal. Can you believe that? He went back to the old place, all English settlers now, except a part they call Frenchtown, and another part they call the Diggins. That is where the Mi'kmaq people live, the ones that are left. Not many now, not even 100, they say. So he married a Mi'kmaq woman and had more children. Yes, that old man, can you believe it?"
They laughed. The talk shifted to their children. Elise's oldest boy, Scary, a Halliger name, was clever, a great reader, and had a powerful, inquiring mind.
"He wants to go to that Dartmouth school," she said. "As he is, you know, at least part Mi'kmaq, and they are said to take an interest in Indian scholars, so it could come to pass. I don't know if it will, but Doctor wants it. Don't it seem strange from how we lived at the post when were little? We've had big changes in our lives, you know. And maybe Josime? If Amboise had lived."
Gino thought that if Amboise had lived, he would have been run over by a freight wagon as he lay stuporous in the roadway. But he did not say it. The brief hours of family affection began to fade, and by the time the stage left, the sky had clouded over. The coach traveled through a storm that came in repetitive squalls with a few tremendous claps of thunder. minutes of hard rain, followed by a breathless silence until the next wave caught them. The cleansed air chilled, and he thought it would clear, but the interludes of rain turned to sleet and then to snow. A strange end to the summery day. And Jinot, recollecting the visit and the wasted boy lying on the daybed, thought of his own little Amboise, who could never be 12, and the barely healed old wrenching began afresh. 51. Dense Thickets. Minnie had vowed there would be no more children. They were too fragile, too precious. She could not bear to have her heart torn so savagely again. How true, she said, was the often heard and now proven old adage that life was a vale of tears. Of all Jinot's children, Amboise had been especially beloved, a kind of resurrection of Amboise, his burned brother. Jinot knew, guiltily, that he had granted Aaron less affection. Now he vowed to make up for this, and from that moment he and Minnie favored Aaron with love and gifts. Jinot, indifferent to Minnie's long speech telling him she would never again sleep with him, somehow he felt she blamed him for Amboise's death, put a worn bison robe he had used on the Gatineau on the back porch and slept there summer and winter. The children could come to him any time they wished, but he was not the old, affectionate, silly father. So remote was his stare, so remote was he, except with Aaron, that he did not see Minnie's slow decline, how she grew smaller inside the fine striped dress, did not hear her constant wet cough. In the 2 years since Amboise had died, she became gaunt as her spine twisted. She suffered and pulled at her hair to shift the pain. The cooking deteriorated. The children grew out of their ragged and dirty clothes. Jinot made a great kettle of peas porridge once a week, and the children were to help themselves until he discovered Louis laughing as he threw handfuls of something or other, assuredly filthy, into the pot. Then he hired a neighbor widow, Mrs. Joyful Woodlawn, to feed the boys and look after Minnie.
"Of course I'd be glad to look after poor Minnie and the boys. I'll make soups to build Minnie up and beef and taters for the lads, and we'll bring over some water from our well, as it is known to be the best water in the town. There is no better thirst quencher than good water. Mr. Woodlawn was always proud of our well water."
That winter ended like a snapped cable, with days of sudden heat and flooding brooks, thrusting skunk cabbage growing 3 inches a day. The crows began to take their seasonal places, the males stretching their wings to show the long primaries, fanning their tail feathers, their dark eyes aglitter, the lady crows watching coolly from nearby perches, measuring the presentation of every point with critical eyes. Hugh Boss, stumping along on his canes, came over on a Saturday morning and spent several hours sitting beside his daughter's bed. When Jinot came in from the factory, Minnie was sleeping. Hugh Boss got up from his chair and jerked Jinot into the parlor.
"Jinot, Minnie is sick, very sick. Have you had the doctor in?"
"I didn't. No. I did not know it was so bad. I thought she was just poorly, but I did get Mrs. Woodlawn to care for her betimes."
"Betimes? To me she seems not long for this world. I will send the doctor."
And he stalked out, no friend to Jinot. The doctor, not Dr. Mallard, but a mealy-faced old gent with a silk cravat spotted with pork drippings, said it was consumption. Advanced consumption. Nothing to be done, though they could try raw eggs and brandy alternating with hot beef broth. He offered to bleed the woman, but Jinot would not have it. He wished he knew of a Mi'kmaq healer such as they said his great-great-grandmère had been. He thought he had scraped dry the dish of deep sorrow, but time brought a helping of worse. Mrs. Woodlawn bustled into the cell kitchen one morning with her famous jug of well water, swigging a large glass of it herself, bringing some to Minnie. When Jinot came in at noon, he found the widow had gone a ghastly blue and was braced against the table, her hands clenching the edge. She looked at him with a terrible expression and then doubled over in dual spasms of explosive diarrhea and violent vomiting. There was no doubt of the cause. The cholera had been rampant in New York and was now encroaching on smaller towns.
"Save us all!"
said Gino, running into Minnie's room. But the galloping disease had got there first, and Minnie was sinking, fingers and toes clenched with spasm. The twins, Louis and Lancy, still clung to life, but died while their father stood gaping down at them. It could happen so quickly.
"Aaron! Aaron!" he called,
but the boy was not in the house. He found him in the woodshed with a book of tales. He said he had been there since early morning, had breakfasted on a piece of ham fat left over from supper. No, he had not taken Mrs. Woodlawn's water. He felt well, he said, and he looked well. They walked together to Hugh Boss's house.
"Hugh, it's the cholera," said Gino. "It took them. Just me and Aaron's left."
The big man cursed them both, broke down, buried his face in his hands. He was not well. Mrs. Boss, pregnant again, was abed with an illness that resembled cholera, and the youngest children were ill. Mrs. Woodlawn had brought them some of her delicious water before she went to Minnie. Hugh Boss lived, but Mrs. Boss and the three youngest children all died on the same day. After the funerals, weeks passed, dragging their crippled hours like chains. Hugh Boss and Gino hated each other for months, until they met in the cemetery to put up the 7 fresh-cut stones and were reconciled in grief. The memorials bore only the names and dates and the word cholera. They agreed that Gino and Aaron would live with Hugh Boss, sleeping in the haymow and helping with the surviving children until Mrs. Boss's sister could come from Danbury, Connecticut. Gino swore he would keep Aaron with him, keep him safe until he became a man. Yet there was something new to worry about, as Aaron several times said that he wanted to go to Nova Scotia and know his Mi'kmaq relatives. He wanted to be an Indian. By the time young birds were crowding the crow's nests, the cholera plague had eased, and Gino and Aaron returned to their silent house. For Gino, the palliative was work, and he spent much time with Mr. Bone, now shrunken and stooped, but still making great plans and filled with energy unseemly for an old man. He spoke of starting a handsaw manufacturing factory. He talked of setting up a rolling mill and making his own steel. Anything could excite his fertile imagination. Though axes remained Mr. Bone's true love, he wanted new lands to conquer. He sat up nights roving over the world through the pages of his swollen atlas, for it had been dropped in the bath and dried page by page over the stove, and reading foreign newspapers.
"I think," said Mr. Bone after a year of consideration, "that the best course is to set up an axe manufactory abroad. Trees grow all over the world, and everywhere men need houses and buildings. They need axes. My life has ever been dedicated to the removal of the forest for the good of men. I have studied countries where there is a burgeoning population, plenty of trees, and a need for axes. The list is not a long one, but I would value your opinion before I take any steps."
Gino laid his hand on the atlas and waited. Mr. Bone's peculiar list named Norway, Russia, Java, New Zealand, and Brazil. Gino said, "Why not go to the western forests of this country? They say there are forests that cannot be measured from Ohio westward to the end of the land." Mr. Bone ignored this.
"It will be simpler for a swift establishment of the factory if the inhabitants speak English. That removes 4 of the countries from the list and leaves us with New Zealand."
"They speak English in New Zealand?"
"Those in government and control do so. The country is allied to England, where they do speak English. The New Zealand natives speak some gibberish of their own, but many have learned English."
"But do they have trees there?" asked Gino, who fancied New Zealand was mostly desert and salt flats. He had only a vague idea of the country's location, perhaps near India. Mr. Bone leaned back in his chair. He smiled the smile of a man who knows a great secret.
Yes, they have trees. Especially do they have certain kauri trees, which experts describe as the most perfect trees on the earth, truly enormous trees that rise high with all the branches clustered conveniently at the top. The wood of these trees is without blemish, light, odorless, of a delightful golden color, easy to carve and work, strong and long-wearing. I have learned that a nascent trade in poor-quality axes is in progress through the efforts of a bumptious Australian entrepreneur who was once a convict, now working in New Zealand. Before I make my decision, I have decided to go to New Zealand and see these forests for myself. They are said by men who know timber to be one of the wonders of the world. You must accompany me. I have arranged passage. We leave in a fortnight. Mr. Joseph Dogg will manage the factory while we are away. He is thoroughly competent to do so.
Gineau opened his mouth to say something, then consulted the atlas. It was far, far, a long, skinny, wasp-waisted country at the bottom of the world.
Mr. Bone, I have sworn to keep Aaron close to me until he attains manhood. You know my sad history, sir. He is all I have left.
Quite simple. Tell him to pack his trunk. He shall come with us. A husky lad is useful when traveling.
But Aaron only shook his head and went into one of his long, silent spells. For days he did not respond to Gineau's badgering and pleading. He smiled distantly as if his thoughts were too lofty to share.
Father, I do not wish to go on the ocean. It is my desire to go to Nova Scotia and find our family, whatever cell relatives may be there. I wish to know that life.
And you would do better to go west to Manitoulin Island and seek out your Uncle Josim. He returned to the old ways.
But not Mi'kmaq?
No, because Mi'kmaq old ways no longer exist. And because he loved that Ottawa girl I have told you about many times. If you wish to know the old forest life of our people, you must find Josim. But you are too young to make that journey alone. Come with us to this New Zealand, and on our return I will go with you to Manitoulin Island, and together we will find Josim.
But secretly he thought the shadow of white men ways might have lengthened far across the land to touch even Manitoulin Island and the Ottawa. Aaron listened to all of this. It did seem best to find Josim, a person with a name and a place, but he would not go over the ocean. He wrote a short letter and pinned it to Gineau's black coat.
Dear Father, I do not go to New Zealand. I go Nova Scotia, then I go find Uncle Josim. When I return, you hear my good stories.
He believed the old Mi'kmaq ways, whatever they were, could not be utterly lost, and started walking north, hopeful. Gineau wrote to Elise that he was going with Mr. Bone across the ocean. Anything might happen to him, for he was crippled and not young, and he wanted her to know where he was. Aaron, he wrote, had refused to come with him.
I will write to you, he promised.
2 days before he left, he had a long answer from Elise, who was unhappy with his news of New Zealand.
It seems everyone is going far away. Aaron is repeated here with Scary. I fear we must allow these boys their desires, even know how cruel the world may treat them.
She described the upsetting scene between Scary and Dr. Halliger.
Scary come home from that Dartmouth college very sad. What is wrong with you, Scary? Are you not pleased to be at home again among those who love you? You are unnatural quiet, said the doctor. Dear Gineau, I fetched a venison pasty from the pantry, Scary's favorite food. I thought sad because he was mourning Humphrey. We all mourn him, you know. The doctor told us many times that the end was come. We try to make his hour on earth with us as happy. Scary said, I have known that for years as you. Then what is the matter? Is it the school? Doctor spoke very loud, but Scary would not say nothing. Doctor said, it is the school. Something has happened. Is that not so? Scary made a sore face and said, they want us who came there because we have Indian blood. They want us to be missionaries. All are to be missionaries. return to our tribe and preach gospel. I was never in a tribe. I have nobody to preach to. I want study law. But they said the only study for Indians was theology.